This is VOA News in Washington. I'm Jeff Custer. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu Tuesday repeated Israel's intention to send troops into the southern Gaza city of Rafah, saying the city on the Egyptian border is Hamas's last stronghold. During an appearance in Israel Tuesday, Netanyahu said Israel will complete the elimination of the Hamas battalions, including in Rafah. He said there is no force in the world that will stop them. The possibility of an Israeli invasion has raised the international alarm over the fate of 1.4 million Palestinians sheltering in Rafah, most of whom are displaced from other parts of the Gaza Strip. U.S. State Department spokesman Matthew Miller, speaking in Washington, said the Biden administration hasn't seen Israel's plan but remains opposed.
We have made clear to Israel that we think a full-scale military invasion of Rafah would have an enormously harmful effect on those civilians, and that it would ultimately hurt Israel's security. So it's not just a question of Israel presenting a plan to us. We have made clear to them that we think that there is a better way to achieve what is a legitimate goal.
U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and U.S. Joint Chiefs Chairman General C.Q. Brown Jr. were on Capitol Hill Tuesday to voice their support for the Pentagon's $850 billion budget for 2025, as questions remain as to whether lawmakers will support current spending needs for Israel or Ukraine. The Senate Armed Forces Committee hearing Tuesday was the first time lawmakers on both sides were able to question the Pentagon's top civilian and military leadership on the administration's Israel strategy following Tel Aviv's deadly strike on the world's central kitchen humanitarian aid workers in Gaza. In his opening statement, Defense Secretary Austin said Congress must pass more aid for Ukraine.
The price of U.S. leadership is real, but it is far lower than the price of U.S. abdication.
This is VOA News. Europe's highest human rights court ruled Tuesday that its member nations have an obligation to protect their citizens from the effects of climate change. The European Court of Human Rights sided with the Swiss Association of Elders for Climate Protection, a group of 2,500 women with an average age of 73. The court ordered the Swiss state to pay the association about $87,000 in damages. Climate advocates are excited about the ruling. Co-director of the Climate Change Litigation Network, Lucy Maxwell, told the Reuters news agency the ruling sets a good precedent for other communities filing similar lawsuits.
The biggest impact of today's ruling will be for the communities who already have climate cases against their governments to challenge their weak climate action. So there are a number of different cases in Europe already where communities are taking their governments to court. So, for example, in Belgium, in the Netherlands, in the Czech Republic, in Spain, in Sweden, in Italy.
The court rejected two other climate-related cases on procedural grounds. Five forensic experts asked by the Reuters news agency to review a photo of a dead body of a prominent opposition leader from Chad, killed in February by government troops, said the politician appears to have been shot in the side of the head at close range. Reuters correspondent Olivia Chan has more.
The findings call into question statements by Chadian officials that Yahya Dilo was shot dead in an exchange of fire on February 28th. Professor Derek Pounder, a UK-based pathologist, said the visible gunshot wound was incompatible with a scenario of an exchange of gunfire.
This is a contact wound to the head. In other words, the muzzle of the gun was pressed against the head when the shot was fired.
On February 29th, Chad's communications minister said that Dilo had fired on security forces sent to detain him for alleged involvement in violent clashes and that he died of injuries sustained when they shot back.
That's Reuters correspondent Olivia Chan reporting. Ireland's parliament has officially elected a new prime minister. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
Irish lawmaker Simon Harris has been elected prime minister by a vote in parliament. At 37, he's the country's youngest ever leader. He succeeds Leo Varadkar, who unexpectedly resigned last month. The new leader faces challenges including a strained health service, soaring housing costs, and an exodus of lawmakers from his centre-right Fianna Fáil party. Harris has said he plans to keep the coalition government in Ireland going until March 2025, when an election must be held. Opposition parties say the Irish public deserves an earlier election. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
In Washington, I'm Jeff Custer. This is VOA News.
Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Those crossing borders, mostly women and children, are arriving in remote areas with little to nothing and in desperate need of food, water, shelter, and medical care. Many families have been separated and arrived in distress. People and children have witnessed or experienced appalling violence.
That was UNHCR spokeswoman Olga Sarado on the continuing flood of refugees from Sudan and the impact on its neighbors like Chad. Details coming up. Also, South Africa's electoral court overturns a decision to bar former President Zuma from the May 29th election. And in Kenya, nationwide strike by medics nears its fourth week. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. A short time ago, South Africa's electoral court ruled that former President Jacob Zuma can run in the May 29th general election, overturning an electoral commission decision to bar him. The commission last week said the 81-year-old Zuma, who is campaigning for a new party, could be on the ballot because of a 2020 could not be on the ballot because of a 2021 contempt of court conviction. Lawyers for Zuma and the party argued the case did not disqualify him because it followed civil rather than criminal proceedings. The election is expected to be the most competitive since the advent of democracy in 1994. The ruling African National Congress is struggling in the polls due to a weak economy and allegations of corruption and mismanagement. It risks losing its parliamentary majority for the first time since the end of apartheid. Among the parties seeking to capitalize on the ANC's weakness is Zuma's new Umkhonto We Sees We Party. The United Nations Refugee Agency reports thousands of people flee Sudan every day in search of safety as the conflict, which has been raging for nearly a year, shows no signs of abating. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
More than 8.5 million people, including 1.8 million refugees, have been forced to flee their homes since war erupted on April 15, 2023. Making this one of the largest displacement and humanitarian crises in the world. The United Nations Refugee Agency reports fighting between the Sudanese armed forces and paramilitary rapid support forces has shattered people's lives. It says attacks on civilians are escalating. Human rights violations are widespread and rampant, and the economy has collapsed. UNHCR spokeswoman Olga Sarado says thousands of desperate Sudanese, mainly women and children, are fleeing across borders every day as if the emergency had started yesterday and not a year ago.
Chad has experienced the largest refugee arrivals in its history, while teams from UNHCR and partners continue to work and relocate refugees to expanded and new settlements. Over 150,000 remain in border areas in overcrowded and unsanitary conditions, mainly and largely due to funding shortfalls.
UNHCR reports more than 1,800 people are arriving in South Sudan every day, increasing pressure on overstretched infrastructure and worsening the vast humanitarian needs. It says nearly 640,000 people, many of them South Sudanese returnees, have arrived in the country to date. Sarado says other neighboring countries of asylum, including the Central African Republic, Egypt, and Ethiopia, also are experiencing large daily inflows of Sudanese refugees.
Those crossing borders, mostly women and children, are arriving in remote areas with little to nothing and in desperate need of food, water, shelter, and medical care. Many families have been separated and arrived in distress. People and children have witnessed or experienced appalling violence and making psychosocial support a priority.
As the conflict continues, Serrato says more people will be forced to flee Sudan to neighboring countries. She warns many are likely to risk their lives by embarking on long, dangerous journeys seeking safety in countries further afield. UNHCR statistics show more Sudanese refugees are going to Europe, with 6,000 arriving in Italy from Tunisia and Libya since the beginning of 2023, an almost six-fold increase from the previous year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Mozambique President Filipe Nyusi says more than 100 people died after a ferry boat sank off the northern coast of the country, with almost 20 others still missing. Another 10 people have been rescued. An official from the country's Maritime Transport Institute said the overloaded fishing boat was not licensed to transport people but was carrying 130 passengers when it was hit by a tidal wave. Nampula province authorities say the passengers were reportedly fleeing a cholera outbreak. Government data shows Mozambique has recorded 15,051 cases of cholera since October, resulting in 32 deaths. For several years, separatists in Cameroon's English-speaking regions have fought the national government. Hundreds of civilians and fighters on both sides have died. John Makum Mbaku, non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institute in Washington, tells me the issue dates back 140 years. In 1884, Germany annexed Cameroon but lost it after World War I when it was partitioned between Britain and France.
4/5 of Cameroon went to France. 1/5 went to Great Britain, and Great Britain then divided its 1/5 into two parts. And the argument given by the British at the time was that the portion that they had received from the former German colony consisted mainly of a Christian South and a Muslim North. And according to the British, they felt that it would be very difficult for the two units to stay together. So they divided them into two. And so you came up with the mandate, the Southern Cameroon's mandate, and then the Northern Cameroon's mandate. And of course, after World War II, the mandates were transferred to the United Nations and they became trust territories. So now we have three trust territories representing most of what was previously the German colony of Cameroon.
The French part of Cameroon won independence in 1960 and was joined a year later by the smaller English-speaking British zone to the west, forming modern-day Cameroon. At the time, many in the British territory wanted to form their own state, but Professor Mbaku says they were not given the option under a United Nations organized referendum.
The UN conducted plebiscites, referendums, in Southern Cameroons and Northern Cameroons, and granted them only two options. So the independence option was taken off the list. And the reason was the British insisted that they didn't want the independence option for fear that an independent Southern Cameroon or an independent Northern Cameroon would become dependent on the British. And so what they did was they gave them the two options, and Southern Cameroon voted to join Independent Republic of Cameroon, and Northern Cameroon voted to join Nigeria. And so Northern Cameroon is now part of Nigeria today, and Southern Cameroon became a part of the Republic du Cameroun. And so in October 1961, there was unification.
Professor Mbaku says secessionist sentiments have simmered ever since because problems between the Francophone and Anglophone regions began not long after unification. English speakers began to feel they were marginalized in favor of their French-speaking compatriots.
French became the language of the Federation, and English was being pushed aside. And so you can see, for example, that the first university in the country was the University of Yaoundé, and many Anglophones who went to that university found out that there were no professors who who were capable of teaching in English. And so that became some of the problems that Anglophones in the Federation started having. In addition to that, most of the government was made up primarily of Francophones. Most of the leaders in the country were primarily Francophones, and the Anglophone leaders were marginalized.
The separatist movement remained on the political fringe until late 2016, when English-speaking lawyers and teachers started protesting against having to work in French. The government cracked down and civilians were killed in clashes with police. In October 2017, more than 20 were killed during marches, and not long after, the separatist clashes began, and it is still going on. Professor Mbaku is from Cameroon and has written and researched extensively on the matter, says colonialism made a significant impact and a significant difference in the way Cameroonians live.
And I think that in order for you to have peaceful coexistence, you have to be able to produce institutions that would allow these two groups to live together peacefully, as you see what is happening in Canada, where the Francophones and the Anglophones have been able to live together peacefully and participate in both government and the economy without any group marginalizing the other.
Professor Mbaku told me that Cameroon's government should sit down with separatists peacefully to convince them that separation is not a good idea. A line of communication should be established that is mutually acceptable for both sides. Otherwise, Mbaku warns, Cameroon will not see peace anytime soon. Nigeria's health ministry says sky-high inflation, low salaries, and an overstretched healthcare system are leading thousands of doctors and nurses to leave Nigeria every year for better opportunities abroad. Authorities say 15,000 to 16,000 doctors have departed in the past 5 years. That leaves Africa's most populous country with just 55,000 doctors for a population of 220 million. Most are concentrated in large cities. The rest of the country has only two doctors for every 10,000 people. The French news agency AFP reports that doctors in Nigeria's public and in some private hospitals make just $2,000 to $4,000 each year. Parliament is considering a bill to require medical graduates to work for 5 years in Nigeria before obtaining a full license to practice. And a new law requires nurses to practice at least 2 years in Nigeria before they can leave the country. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs, and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Hundreds of Kenyan doctors joined a demonstration in the streets of the capital, Nairobi, today as a nationwide strike by medics neared its fourth week. The 7,000 members of the Kenya Medical Practitioners, Pharmacists and Dentists Union are demanding better pay and working conditions. The strike is disrupting health care at public hospitals. The doctors chanted solidarity forever as they marched to the health ministry and then on to Parliament to present a petition highlighting their grievances. The union last week rejected an offer from the government that included paying arrears under a 27 collective bargaining agreement and hiring training doctors on permanent contracts. In March, a labor court ordered the union to suspend the strike, and last week it set a 14-day deadline for the completion of negotiations. Kenyan President William Ruto, who has embarked on cost-cutting measures since taking office in 2022, has ruled out any further concessions. Rwanda is marking the 30th anniversary of the 1994 genocide in which more than 800,000 people were killed as families and friends turned against each other. Nicole Wiedersheim, Human Rights Watch Deputy Director in Washington, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that an organization staffer in Rwanda at the time warned the U.S. government and aid groups about the impending violence, but few officials were taking action.
Alison DeForge was the Rwanda research lead for Human Rights Watch at the time of the genocide. She had spent a lot of time and working and living in Rwanda and had a lot of friends who she was in real-time communication with by phone who were under attack during the genocide. And she was in D.C. I was with another NGO at the time. This was 30 years ago, so I was quite young. And I remember specifically sitting in a brief that she was giving to everybody and anybody who would listen at the U.S. Committee for Refugees, talking about how friends of hers were under immediate attack and the scale of the violence that was unfolding that she was listening to on the telephone. She was giving the backdrop of what Rwanda and Burundi were going through in the peace negotiations and what was happening in a country that many people in Washington didn't even know where it was located. And it really also wasn't a country, even if you were following African issues, Rwanda and Burundi weren't really high on your list of countries at the time. So there was a lot of a huge learning curve. And at the same time, trying to tell people, where is this country? How did this happen? What is happening? What is the nature of the violence? Which, now in hindsight, 20, 30 years later, we know, and those of us that study atrocities and genocide definitely can see the signs and the warning signs and how resources are mobilized.
Describe some of those warning signs. If you remember, what happened with the president?
So, a lot of people have reflected on whether these peace agreements that were reached were fully bought into from all sides in these countries. Did the opposition truly believe? Were they credible? Or was this one man or a series of leaders signing agreements that they didn't do the work to make sure that all sides of the conflict at the time and the political opposing sides were bought into the peace agreement? Clearly, people felt like it was a threat to their existence and their political existence. There were stockpiling of weapons and stockpiling of machetes and things like this going on prior to the outbreak of violence that even the UN and the UN peacekeeping forces were reporting back to New York. All of these signs that really the Rwandan genocide ended up being a turning point in the world for people to really focus in on how can something of this magnitude happen and happen so quickly? What signs did we miss? How do we become smarter?
And how powerful hateful messages can be when they're being broadcast.
How motivating they can be. There's also been a lot of look at isolated communities and people who are really listening primarily to radio messaging and they're isolated farming communities. Where are they getting the messaging? Not only there's been a lot of talk about why didn't people jam the radios and stop that, but also nobody trying to counter those messages with other radio messaging, right? If you can't jam the radio or if that's a step too far for countries to do, the U.S. definitely had it in its ability to do it, but chose not to.
Why? Why did countries like the United States choose not to?
You have to remember where the U.S. foreign policy apparatus was at that time. You had a new administration, the Clinton administration, who inherited a very fraught situation of U.S. troops getting killed and targeted in Somalia, commonly referred to as the Black Hawk Down era of Somalia. Clinton inherited that. He also had a crumbling Haiti, with Aristide being a democratically elected leader of Haiti, getting under threat and getting pushed out of Haiti. They were looking at this. They were also embroiled in dealing with Bosnia. And really, just generically speaking, you can see that the U.S. prioritizes working on the crumbling of Yugoslavia and trying to get Yugoslavia leaders. And the Clinton administration was making calculus with all these various things spinning.
And that was Nicole Wiedersheim, Human Rights Watch Deputy Director in Washington, speaking with VOA's Carol Van Dam. Millions of people in the United States, from Texas to Maine, looked to the sky to witness a rare total solar eclipse. VOA's Ken Fabo attended a viewing event hosted by NASA and Purdue University at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway yesterday, and he has more.
The decision to come to Indianapolis, Indiana's famous Motor Speedway to join the crowd of spectators witnessing a total solar eclipse came at the last minute for Enrique Catalan and his family. It was supposed to be a regular day of school for his children.
We're skipping today, yes. They're approved by us.
Catalan and his family drove 2 hours from northern Indiana to witness something that had left an impression on him as a teenager in Mexico during a partial eclipse.
The experience, it was unique to me. So that's why we're here, because I remember when it happened when I was young. And now I wanted them to experience it as well. Well, they are going to experience the total eclipse.
The racetrack was one of several locations where NASA and its partners hosted programming in the Path of Totality, the swath of the U.S. that can see the moon completely blocking the sun as the eclipse makes its way northeast. Charles and Kathy Maher from Chicago, Illinois, felt sharing the event with the massive crowd in Indianapolis was a unifying moment in a country politically polarized in a presidential election year.
Nobody's going to be talking about what side the sun is on or the moon is on, or, you know.
It's not red or blue. It's
right, right, exactly. Right. So, yeah, it is sort of a little break from everything that's going on.
Today, millions of Americans will stand together looking up at the sky in awe and wonder at this cosmic coincidence that makes our moon look like it's exactly the same size as the sun.
NASA Deputy Administrator Pam Melroy says her agency's efforts to study this rare event weren't isolated to just a few locations across the country.
We have a program where some people have been trained to use solar telescopes all around the country.
Meng Chang is president of Indiana's Purdue University, which boasts a number of graduates who became NASA astronauts. He hopes the accessibility of the eclipse to a large number of young Americans might help inspire them to pursue careers in science.
It's not just a watch party for 3 minutes. It is a lifelong educational journey, and today is a very meaningful special stop along that journey.
For those who missed witnessing the 2024 total solar eclipse, the next opportunities to see one firsthand in the United States won't occur until 2044 and 2045. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Indianapolis, Indiana.
In desert Namibia, invasive acacia trees are sucking up valuable groundwater. Now a company has found a novel way to use fungi to turn the cut-down trees into eco-friendly bricks. Vitolia Angula has the story from Brackwater, Namibia.
Mycelium density 1. Hilma Nashandi grows fungi at Mysoheb in Brakvater, just north of Namibia's capital, Windhoek. The company sells the mushrooms in retail shops, but the main product is underneath. The mushrooms, root-like mycelia, grow in a substrate of invasive acacia trees ground into sawdust.
So the mycelium in the substrate form a bond. Mycelium now behaves like a glue that is binding the substrates together as it feeds on it. Now you have more of like a block. So it will require some strength for you to like break it apart.
Workers press the blocks into square bricks. They are baked for 12 hours to increase their strength and durability and left to cool for another 24 hours before they are ready to use. Hafeni Tata is the supervisor of the brick making section at the Mysoheb project.
This is our finished product of extracting the brick. This is a very, very, very strong brick. Its strength is about 35 MP, and it weighs about, as a finished product, it weighs about 13 kilograms.
The finished bricks are tougher than concrete, Mysoheb says. Gilbert Shava is an architect on the company's building prototype project. He says the bricks also provide good insulation, making them ideal for Namibia's hot summers and cold winters. Plus, he says, making them does not generate much planet-warming carbon dioxide.
So the advantages of this brick is that, the carbon footprint of the brick, when you compare with the traditional bricks, it doesn't consume a lot of, it doesn't have cement in, because the process of making cement, that's where you've got a lot of carbon emission.
Mysoheb says the government wants to get rid of at least 300 million tons of invasive acacia trees every 15 years. The company says it could turn those trees into bricks to help address the country's housing needs. Vitalio Angula, VOA News, Brakvater, Namibia.
And And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Yeheye Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Pete Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.